Welcome to the Science Podcast for December 9th, 2011. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, using satellite imagery to detect measles outbreaks, how honeybee swarms make decisions, and a proposal to bolster research funding in Europe, plus a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Measles is a vaccine-preventable disease, yet seasonal epidemics are commonplace in many developing countries. While scientists have long suspected a correlation between such epidemics and seasonal fluctuations in population density, a study this week was the first to quantitatively confirm this relationship using an unexpected data source, nighttime satellite imagery. A team of researchers uncovered a striking correlation between nighttime brightness and measles outbreaks, confirming that as people aggregate together, transmission of contagious diseases increases. Lead author Nita Bardi spoke with me about her unusual methodology and the implications of the findings.
Measles outbreaks in Niger show very strong seasonal patterns of incidence. And although we knew that this was consistently observed, the reason for that type of seasonality was unknown. Based on measles epidemiology and previous literature, it's generally accepted that measles incidence increases as a result of host aggregation. So it was suspected that that was the cause, but it's nearly impossible to measure short-term changes in population density at high spatial resolution in a place like Niger or at a city level for the most part. After a lot of failed attempts to find an existing way to do this, it became clear that not only was this information going to be useful and necessary, it was clear that a new method was going to be necessary to get the information.
So what drew you to Niger in the first place?
Niger has a very high birth rate, which is an important source of susceptible individuals for childhood diseases like measles. The disease records in Niger are also excellent, and there was a lot of information available about the incidence. In some areas, we don't really know what the measles burden is, and it's easier when you know what you're dealing with.
And so what sort of history of measles outbreaks exist in Niger?
So the case reports that we used for this analysis were 10 years of weekly reported measles incidence at the district level. Some of those districts are as small as a single city.
You explained that it was clear that you were going to need a new method here for determining sort of the epidemiology of measles. So what was your strategy exactly?
Our initial strategy was really just question-driven. We were trying to find out why these seasonal patterns of measles existed, and we never intended to invent a new method to do that. We fully expected that there would be a way in place to measure those things. And we looked at census data and surveys, ethnographic research. We looked at just about everything. We looked at many different types of satellite imagery as well. But ultimately, it turned out that the only real direct signature of human movement or changes in population density is going to be anthropogenic light that's emitted. So in general, the studies of night lights or of nighttime light imagery that have been done have used composite images to either look at long-term trends or to just identify areas that are stably populated. So we sort of turned that around and looked at single images and looked at the differences between them.
Tell me about the areas that you were looking at and the time frames and how you kind of set all of this up to compare it then to the measles data.
We essentially looked at images and only used images that occurred during the time period for which we had measles incidence. And these images are sensitive to environmental conditions and other types of illumination. So we had to
Things like cloud cover and
cloud cover, lunar illumination, solar illumination. You have to be very careful about selecting individual images. So that's kind of where a lot of the time went when we were getting this off the ground. It's a very laborious process to select those images.
I can imagine. And you were looking at a few cities in specific, right?
Yeah. So we specifically looked at three cities for which measles data were available. And beyond that, we looked further at one city very closely at patterns within the city.
Okay, so you were essentially taking nighttime aerial photography and sort of looking at the brightness of densely populated areas and comparing that to measles data from that same time frame. So what exactly did you find here?
What really clearly came out, surprisingly, was, I mean, it's surprising how clearly it came out, that the brightness of these cities is strongly correlated, significantly correlated with the measles transmission in these cities. So that is to say that during the dry season, when measles incidence is very high, the brightness of these cities is very high, indicating an increase in relative population density. And during the rainy season, both measles and population density as measured by brightness decrease.
So you essentially confirmed very clearly, I guess, that as population density increases, you sort of get an increased incidence of measles. And that's fascinating. But then you also had the opportunity to be looking more closely at one city, as you said, the capital city of Niger. So what did you find? How did that sort of study compare to the broader resolution study of the three cities?
So that was great. And that, again, was possible because of how excellent the disease data are in Niger. There were daily reports of measles cases within the city at the commune level. So there's three communes within this city. So that made it possible and made it logical to really look more closely at the satellite images, which can give us up to 1 kilometer resolution. So when we did that, we looked at the measles incidence for the three communes, and we looked at the brightness for the three communes. And what wasn't obvious at the city level is that there's actually some interesting variation between the communes. So there's one commune that has a slightly lagged incidence of measles, a slightly lagged seasonal increase in measles. And it turns out that the brightness signature is also lagged. And that was actually really interesting and unexpected. In general, because of the high spatial resolution of these images, we were able to do similar analyses for the other cities, but without the corresponding measles data. So they don't have the same validation. But, you know, it's certainly something that would be a useful tool, even in the absence of disease data, to try and identify areas and times that would be high risk for density-dependent disease transmission.
So, you know, you're talking about these population fluctuations that happen seasonally and annually. What drives these population fluctuations?
In general, in the case of Niger, there is a lot of agriculture. So there's a lot of agricultural labor. So during the rainy season, it's not uncommon to have an agriculturally related job in a place that might not be in a city center. During the dry season, it certainly makes sense to seek employment in an urban area, you know, during a time when agriculture isn't really happening.
So the cities see greater populations during the dry season and the rural areas see greater populations during the rainy seasons?
Right. And those rural areas are sparsely populated in the sense that even if there's more people there, they're not living in dense areas. So it's not a trigger for something like measles transmission.
So this is a really, really great relationship that you've sort of pinned down that's been difficult to pin down. And so, you know, in what direction do you see this research going? And what are the eventual applications that you're working towards?
Most obviously, I think, and most immediately, this could certainly be used to look at patterns of disease incidence for any type of density-dependent disease. Certainly, there are agriculturally dependent workforces in a lot of places throughout Africa and even other places. And so it seems like, you know, that's kind of an easy one. Beyond that, I think something that we're trying to do is to be able to use this towards other questions of global health. And we're looking into being able to look at displaced people, you know, to be able to detect changes in brightness due to conflict or disaster when people leave or resources are lost, to be able to detect those changes and then to maybe be able to detect, you know, where they resettle. One of the benefits of really knowing where and when population density is increasing is that you can plan your intervention strategies accordingly. And so we show that at one point a reactive campaign was done. So that's done because of an ongoing outbreak. And we were able to show that this campaign was done after population density had peaked and was starting to decline in two of the areas that are the most populous and really experience the bulk of the measles burden in that epidemic. So having a good idea of, you know, where population density is going to increase and when that's going to happen can give you some information about what your risk areas are and what your risk times are without necessarily relying on real-time disease reports, which can be delayed.
Well, Nita Bardi, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Nita Bardi and colleagues report the use of nighttime brightness as a proxy for population density and measles outbreaks in this week's Science.
In human society, headbutting is not a welcome form of communication. But for honeybees, it is an integral part of collective decision-making. For instance, when a swarm chooses a new hive site. A team of researchers reports this week that individual honeybee scouts advertise potential hive sites to the swarm through so-called waggle dancing. But when multiple scouts must compete for their choice of hive sites, the gloves come off and competitors headbutt their opponents into silence until a collective decision is reached. Such a system is similar to the cross-inhibition that occurs between neurons in mammalian brains, as lead author Thomas Seeley explained.
We were studying the decision-making process whereby a swarm of honeybees chooses its new home. This is usually a cavity in a tree. And this is a collective decision-making process in which several hundred of the oldest bees in the swarm, these are, we call them scout bees, fly out, search around in the countryside, find prospective home sites, and then work together to choose the one best site for their new home. And in the past, we've studied the excitatory communication signals that the scout bees use among themselves to make this decision. And in this current study, we focused instead on an inhibitory, an important inhibitory signal that they use. It's called the stop signal. And the reason it's called the stop signal is that it, when one scout sends this stop signal to a dancing bee, it inhibits the dancing bee from further dancing. In a nutshell, what we found is that this inhibitory signal is an important part of the decision-making system because it helps the swarms avoid the problem of deadlock. If they find two very good sites, they have to choose one or the other, and without this inhibition, they can end up with split decisions, which can be very dangerous for a swarm. It means the swarm can't move as a unit to one or the other new homes because it tends to split itself.
So let's talk about bees a bit more.
Okay.
What kind of decisions do they need to make, and how do they typically communicate those?
Well, when we're talking about bees here, we're talking about a honeybee colony, a whole colony of bees. And a colony of bees functions as a unit, like our own bodies do. And so, like our own bodies, a colony of bees has to make decisions constantly. Every day, for example, it has to make the decision of where its foragers should go foraging, which patches of flowers are the best ones. It also has to make the decision of, moment by moment, whether to turn up the heat production in the hive or to turn it down for reasons of thermoregulation. It also has to make other decisions such as whether or not to build more combs, which is the infrastructure in which the whole colony functions. And a key feature of all these decisions is the fact that they are distributed, or it's a collective decision-making. There is a queen in a colony, but she's not making these decisions. She's just laying eggs in the nest. So these are decisions that have to be worked out collectively by the worker bees in a honeybee colony.
And you also note in your paper and what you just said, there are some parallels between the decision-making strategies in a colony of bees and in the primate brain. What kind of parallels are there?
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. There are a number of parallels, but the most basic is that both in nervous systems and in honeybee colonies, they face a problem that the evidence that they're going to base the decision on comes in noisily. There's some information about, for example, about this nest site coming in at this time, and then a few minutes later, some information about another nest site comes into the swarm. One of the problems both the nervous system faces and a swarm faces is that it has to integrate information that over a period of time. Another similarity is that in both systems, there's no master control unit. There's no unit within a brain or within a swarm of bees that has a synoptic knowledge of all the information that's accumulating in the system. So the way both systems deal with make a lot of their decisions by running what we like to call an evidence race. If you've got two alternatives, for example, the system works by having populations of the system. In the case of the brain, it would be a population of neurons. In the case of a swarm, it would be a population of scout bees. Populations of these units that are, in a sense, voting for option A or option B. The way the evidence race works is the system sees which of those two populations builds up to a threshold level first, and that would be the chosen option. So it's a basic problem of bringing noisy evidence in, integrating it, and then monitoring which population associated with which option first musters enough support.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. I like the metaphor of a race. I think that's really helpful.
It is, and it is the heart of the thing. And there's one more thing that's similar between these two, the way a brain of neurons makes decisions and the way a swarm of bees makes decisions, is that they both involve inhibitory interactions between these populations that are accumulating evidence. That really sharpens up the decision-making and avoids this problem of split decisions or stalemates.
Can you tell us about your experimental setup that you used to look at the behavior of the bees?
Yeah. The experimental setup is one which enables us to watch the entire process of a swarm choosing its home. And to do this, we have to go to a special island off the coast of Maine. It's where Cornell University has the Shoals Marine Laboratory. It's a 90-acre island, 6 miles out in the Atlantic Ocean, Appledore Island. And the feature of this island is that, first of all, it has no honeybees on the island. And secondly, it has no natural nest sites on the island. The natural nest sites for bees are hollow trees, and there are no large trees on this island. So we can bring a swarm of bees out to the island and set up nest boxes, and the scout bees will leave the swarm, search the island, find our nest boxes, and because we can monitor the swarm and we can monitor the nest boxes, we can follow the whole process. For the experiments reported in this paper, we set out two very good nest boxes. So we gave the bees a very difficult problem, choosing between two good options. And we would then label the scout bees with different color paint marks for the two boxes. And then we observed how those scouts interacted. Each scout, after she checked out her nest box, how she interacted with the other scouts when she returned to the swarm. And that's when we discovered, to our amazement, that the bees use this stop signal in a cross or mutual inhibitory fashion. The scout bees, when they come back to the swarm, first they will advertise their site, the site they found, by producing the excitatory signal of waggle dances. But after they've done that for a while, they walk around on the swarm, and if they encounter a bee performing a waggle dance for the other nest box, they will go over and inflict a stop signal, produce a stop signal onto that bee dancing for the other box, and effectively inhibit her advertisement of her site.
So we've seen this fascinating behavior in bees, and how does this lead us to resolving split decision-making?
Yes, it helps the bees resolve the problem of split decision-making, which in particular is the case that happens when you've got two good sites and the threshold number of bees, scout bees, is reached at both sites at the same time. And the way the bees solve this, avoid this problem, is this cross-inhibition means that as soon as one site gets a little bit ahead, even if both sites are equally good, as soon as one site gets a little bit ahead, it starts to suppress the buildup of bees at the other site. So only one reaches the threshold first.
And that also brings us back to your parallel with the primate brain. It's a really fascinating parallel. What other kinds of systems use this type of processing?
You know, there are a lot. One remarkable parallel is that colonies of ants, when they have to choose a home, use a similar process of conducting an evidence race. Here again, in an ant colony, there's no individual ant with a synoptic view of the options and the evidence. So they again use an evidence race. But perhaps the most relevant parallel example, as we head into our own presidential election season, are U.S. presidential primary elections. But here again, it's a race to accumulate a threshold level of evidence, a threshold number of delegates. As we know, these parties hold a convention, but in most cases, the choice of the nominee has already been made over the process of the primaries, state by state. And as we know, the person that will be the party's nominee is the person that first reaches that threshold number of delegates. that's a very relevant parallel.
Really interesting. Okay, Thomas Seely, thank you very much.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Thomas Seely of Cornell University is lead author of a new paper on honeybee stop signals and collective decision making, and also of the book Honeybee Democracy. You can read the paper at www.scienceexpress.org.
Despite the European Union's economic uncertainty, the European Commission recently rolled out its 80 billion euro proposal to bolster research and innovation on the continent. Dubbed Horizon 2020, the initiative would fund everything from basic science to near-market product development while boosting such efforts as the European Research Council and the European Institute of Innovation and Technology. Science Deputy News Editor Daniel Clary, who contributed to a news article by Sarah Reardon on the subject, spoke with me about the proposal from his office in London.
It's the European Union's research program, so it's for funding researchers, though it's usually given to groups of researchers in different countries. So it's trying to encourage collaboration across the borders within the European Union. And it's different from U.S. research programs in that it's done in seven-year chunks. So they take a huge amount of money and say, this is what we're going to spend over the next 7 years, and then they stick to that. And so researchers have a lot of stability and they can plan ahead, which is considered quite a good thing. But it does mean that there is a lot of heavy-duty politics that goes into figuring out what that sum total is going to be for the next 7 years. So we're just at the start of that process, figuring out what the next chunk is going to be.
So what are the main objectives of this initiative?
Well, you know, it covers the whole range of science, from basic research being done by one scientist in a lab through to huge collaborations and down right along to very applied research being done in companies. So it covers the whole range. There are a few specific parts of it that have drawn a lot of attention. One of them is the European Research Council, which is very much like the NSF in the United States. So its sole criteria is, you know, what is the scientific excellence of this proposal? And it just awards things on that basis. Another one is the European Institute of Innovation and Technology, which was originally set up, you know, the idea was that Europe needed something like MIT, you know, a sort of institution that was going to be a breeding ground of scientists and engineers. And Europe being Europe, they couldn't decide on one place to put it. So it's a sort of distributed institute that has a headquarters in Budapest, and then it organizes networks of researchers on specific topics in different countries. And then, you know, a lot of training of post-grad goes on. And it encourages people, again, to collaborate across borders.
So the European Institute of Technology has been one of the more controversial aspects of recent research funding in Europe. What's been the source of the criticism of this institute?
I think there was a lot of opposition from universities and researchers in universities saying, we have world-class universities already. Why do we need this new thing? And people at the European Union just really felt this was necessary, and they pushed it through. And it's been going a few years now on a small scale. And I think they feel satisfied with how it's going now. So if Horizon 2020 gets approved, then it will get a big boost of cash, you know, and it'll become much bigger than it is at the moment. So I think it's still in the sort of testing phase.
You kind of alluded to this a little bit, but the main objectives of this program sort of encompass these three areas. And you talked about, you know, the basic science through the European Research Council. And then the other aspects were industrial leadership and societal challenges. Can you talk about how this would address those?
Yes. They've decided to divide up the whole program into three areas. The first is excellent science, which includes things like the European Research Council. So that's where the basic research will mostly be done. The second one is industrial leadership, and there will be a lot more applied research, things that, you know, will help industry. So investing in transport and stuff like that. And the third one was they identified what they call grand challenges, six grand challenges that they think are important to European citizens. And those are things like health and, you know, the aging population, food security, energy security, green transport, climate change, things like that. And so they're setting up funding streams in those specific areas. So, you know, then those will be a mixture of applied research and basic research, I suspect.
So, like you said earlier, I mean, this whole program really runs the gamut from basic ideas, you know, in the lab, all the way through to commercializing and marketing these ideas. What has been the response to this among the European states?
I think the people have been okay about it because they're asking for such a large amount of money and they haven't cut back on basic research. I think there was a fear amongst researchers that with the European economy in, you know, not a very good state, that they would cut back on basic research and want to put more money into, you know, development in industry. And they haven't done that. They've tried to connect it all together, you know, to encourage the sort of flow of ideas from basic research labs through to companies that can commercialize products. Because there is a perception that Europe isn't as good at that as other places like the United States and Japan and other Far East countries, that, you know, we have good ideas, but we're not good at bringing them to market. So that's what this program is trying to encourage, that sort of flow of ideas into companies.
Is there any sort of speculation about how much money will actually be granted to this project?
Not at the moment that I've heard. You know, we haven't really heard anything from the bodies that have to make the decision, which are the European Parliament and the governments of the 27 member states of the European Union. So, you know, those two groups have to get together and fight it out and figure out how much they really want it to get. The European Parliament is usually quite in favor of big European programs like this, and the member states usually want to, you know, keep the budget under control. So they are pulling down and the Parliament's pulling up. That's the way it usually works.
And when will this decision have been finally made? When will we know how much money is going towards Horizon 2020?
Well, this 7-year period starts in 2014. So, you know, the absolute deadline is the end of 2013. But they would usually finish the negotiation before then. But it's probably unlikely to be before the end of next year.
Okay. Well, Daniel Clary, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
Daniel Clary reports on the Horizon 2020 program. You can read the news article by Sarah Reardon in this week's Science.
Finally, David Grimm, Science's online news editor, is here to fill us in on some recent stories on our daily news site. So the first story you have for us is on the origin of bedbugs. Not the most popular topic these days.
Right. Nobody likes bedbugs, and one of the biggest problems with bedbugs is they're almost impossible to get rid of. One of the common insecticides people spray is something known as pyrethroid. This is also an insecticide used against cockroaches, but it hasn't been very effective against bed bugs. That's not really what this new study is about, although this new study helps answer the question about why pyrethroids don't work on bed bugs. But the real point of this new study is, where did bed bugs come from in the first place? How did they get here, and why are they so annoying?
What did these researchers do to figure out where bed bugs came from?
Well, Sarah, what they did in this study was they actually looked at the genetics of a variety of bedbug populations across the U.S. East Coast, and they looked at something called microsatellites. And these are basically short pieces of DNA that vary between populations. They can give you a sense of the genetic diversity of a population. And that a more diverse a population is, the bigger the chance that it came from many different places. You can imagine if you looked all up and down the East Coast and all the bed bugs were highly related to each other, then they probably all came from the same place. But that's not what the researchers found here. They found that all of these populations they looked at were very different from each other, which was surprising because one of the ideas about bed bugs is they had originated in the U.S., possibly on poultry farms. That's where one of the first sightings of bed bugs were. But if they all came from the U.S. and if they all came from the same place, you'd expect them to be very similar, and they weren't. So based on this new result, the researchers are saying, well, it seems like the bedbugs may be coming from a lot of different places, not just the U.S., but potentially a bunch of different places around the world.
Were they able to determine where they were coming from?
They weren't able to determine exactly where, but that's kind of where this pyrethroid resistance comes in, because it turns out that in tropical countries, people in these countries have really drastically scaled up their mosquito control, and they do this by basically putting pyrethroids on everything, spraying indoors and providing bed nets that are coated with pyrethroids. And the more of this sort of insecticide you have around, and if you've got bed bugs around too, the more likely they are to develop resistance. And so it's possible that some of them may have come from the tropics, although given the great amount of genetic diversity, they probably came from a lot of other places.
But you also say the study has something to do with why bed bugs are so annoying.
Right. And what I mean by annoying is, why do their numbers explode so rapidly? And the genetics also provide a clue to that. It turns out that even though the populations that these researchers looked at were very different genetically from each other, when they looked within populations, the bedbugs were extremely highly related. And that suggests there's a lot of inbreeding going on. And researchers already sort of suspected that bed bugs were highly inbred. You see this in other insect species as well. And because bed bugs inbreed so much, the researchers say that actually a single female brought in on a mattress or a couch could actually cause an infestation for an entire building just by herself, because she's having offspring and all these offspring are breeding with each other, and their offspring are breeding with each other, and you just have this huge population explosion. And so that combined with the resistance to the pesticide just makes these guys so hard to get rid of. So the new study not only tells us why they're so annoying, but also gives us a little sense of where they came from, too.
And hopefully that will contribute to eliminating them from our lives.
One would hope.
This next story is about another kind of infestation, farms infested with antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
Exactly. This next story is all about something known as antibiotic resistance, which is a real problem on livestock farms. Farmers tend to feed livestock a whole host of antibiotics, and the reason they do this is because when animals get sick, or even if they have low-lying infections, they tend to grow slower. And farmers, especially those farmers that are producing meat for the general population, want their animals to grow as fast and as big as possible. So a lot of farms load these guys up with a lot of antibiotics. But the concern comes in is because these animals are obviously part of our food chain. And if these animals harbor microbes that are resistant to antibiotics, and somehow these microbes get into us, then all of a sudden we start getting infections that are very hard to treat. And that's been a big concern. It's been hard to prove that that's actually happening, but it's been a big concern among scientists. And this new study asks the question, okay, if we take a farm and we stop treating the animals with antibiotics, Will the antibiotic resistance disappear over the course of a few years?
And why do they expect the antibiotic resistance to go away?
Well, it's a good question. When these microbes develop antibiotic resistance, they usually acquire genes on small circular pieces of DNA known as plasmids. And these plasmids are separate from the bacteria's main genome. And so these plasmids are actually very energetically costly to maintain. You're spending a lot of energy replicating genes, and if you don't need to protect yourself against an antibiotic, why waste the time? And bacteria can actually very easily kick these plasmids out. So the thinking was, okay, we stop treating the livestock with antibiotics, all these plasmids get kicked out, and all of a sudden, these animals are still have bacteria, but these bacteria are no longer antibiotic resistant. At least that was the thinking, but that's not actually what the researchers showed in this new study. They looked at a Canadian pig farm, and in 2007, this pig farm had stopped treating the animals with antibiotics. And what the researchers did was, 2.5 years later, after the farm had stopped treating the animals with antibiotics, they looked through the gut microbes of these animals. They looked through the waste, actually, of the animals, and they tried to see, you know, whether the bacteria that were there were still resistant to antibiotics such as chloric tetracycline. And what they found, which was really surprising, is that most of these bacteria were still highly resistant to the antibiotics. As many as 70 to 100% of them were, depending on the sample that the researchers tested.
And did they have an idea about why they might have stuck around, the resistance might still be there?
Well, it's a good question, because, you know, they would have expected that these bacteria not needing that resistance anymore would have kicked out the plasmids that contain the resistant genes. What they suspect is these plasmids don't just contain genes that help the bacteria fight antibiotics. They also contain genes that may help the bacteria do other things. Pigs on this farm are fed a lot of copper and zinc that's found in pig feed, and it's possible that the bacteria don't like this either, and perhaps they have a gene on their plasmid that helps them deal with these metals. And so it's possible that it, just as a side effect of that, they're keeping the antibiotic resistance around.
So what does the long-term presence of these resistant bacteria mean for farmers and for everybody else?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. Now that we know that this antibiotic resistance is sticking around, what does that mean for us? One of the troubling things is there's a common practice of using swine waste as fertilizer. And so can you imagine you've got this swine waste and you think it doesn't have any antibiotic resistance in it, but it does, and you're spreading it over crops. It's getting into the water supply, potentially. What impact is that going to have on humans? Now, that's really still a black box right now. Researchers just say there's really no conclusive evidence to show that even if there is a lot of antibiotic resistance on farms, that it's actually getting into the human food supply, that it's getting into hospitals, places that could cause a lot of trouble.
This next story is on a more hopeful note, getting usable fuel from plant waste.
Right. We're still on the farm in this next story. The farm here, though, is more of an agricultural farm. And for many years, researchers have been interested in turning plants into fuel, what's called biofuels. And the idea would be that this is an alternative source of energy. And the basic idea is you take a plant and you add a bunch of enzymes or microbes to the plant material. This breaks down the plant into sugars, and the microbes convert these sugars into ethanol and potentially other fuels. And the good part is that gives us an alternative for some of the more problematic ways of creating all sorts of fuels for modern society. The problem is that these microbes don't do a very good job. It's a very expensive process. Also, a lot of the plants that are used for biofuel production right now are things like sugarcane and other important crops. And the issue is that a lot of people in the world need those crops to eat too. And so why are we using them for fuel? And they're taking up a lot of land needed for fuel. So this new study is all about, can we find a better way to convert plants into fuel? And can we use different kinds of plants like trees and grasses, which people don't eat, and even agricultural waste and turn that into fuel?
So this sounds like a great plan. Why aren't we doing that?
Well, the problem with these other sources of biofuel is that they're a lot harder to break down than things like sugarcane. They're a lot hardier. There's a lot more complex molecular chains going on. So the enzymes and the microbes would have to work even harder, and they're already not doing that great of a job in the first place. What this new study did to surmount that problem was it actually took these microbes, and instead of creating these expensive enzyme cocktails, it actually gave the microbes the genes that they needed to break down these really tough plants. And what they found was when they added these microbes to agricultural waste and trees and grasses and things that are traditionally hard to break down, the microbes actually did a pretty good job of it. And not only did they do that, they created things besides ethanol. They created precursors for things like gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. So a larger range of useful fuels.
Yeah, we don't see a lot of ethanol gas tanks here.
Not yet.
So we're not using food anymore to create fuel in this plan, but are there any other downsides that come up?
Well, the enzymes and the microbes are still not working as efficiently as they could be. It's still taking them a lot of work to do this, and the amount of fuel they're generating is pretty low. So this isn't a very efficient process yet. It's not ready for prime time. But the scientists hope that this is an important first step and that this will really eventually get us to where we want to be with biofuels.
Great. And so what else is on the news site this week?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a very interesting story about the earliest bedding ever found. Also, a few stories about new results that are coming out from the Kepler Space Telescope, new findings about extrasolar planets and alien worlds, and what that means for the possibility of finding life out there elsewhere in the universe. For Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about how the U.S. is pouring more money into tackling rare diseases. Also, the continuing saga of Judy Mikovits, and this is the controversial researcher that has linked chronic fatigue syndrome to a mouse retrovirus. She was recently put in jail, and we are following what is going on with that story, so be sure to check that out on Science Insider. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's topic is on the role of nanotechnology in solar energy. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
Thank you, Dave. David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that concludes the December 9th, 2011 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.